comparison of the two, so that Brutus's life is compared with that of Dion of Syracuse. Both were republicans who fought against tyranny. Caesar's life is compared with Alexander's life. Both were world conquerors who were cut off in their prime. Theseus is compared with Romulus. Both were founders of their respective civilizations. Shakespeare is making the imaginative effort to adopt a Plutarchan point of view, to create a pagan world according to Plutarch. It isn't always correct in every archaeological detail, but it's a successful imaginative construct of a pagan Rome. At the heart of this construct is a notion exceedingly important to Shakespeare and to this whole course of lectures on Shakespeare. And that is the very close interconnection between personal life and public life. Shakespeare focuses on the relationship between political values and individual values, how individual human beings operate within the life of the whole city. You are not just an individual person, you are part of Rome. And there are interconnections all the time. Let me use a scene to exemplify this. Act 1, Scene 2, the first big scene, the entrance of Caesar. It's a formal ceremonial. This is, as a matter of fact, a holiday occasion. It's the Feast of the Lupercal. And there is a procession with triumphal music, a large crowd of extras, various senators come in, commoners, unnamed people, most of the leading characters. Cassius, Brutus, Casca, Antony amongst the young men stripped to race in the contest of young men that is part of the Feast of the Lupercal. Calpurnia is there. Perhaps Portia is there. She is not mentioned in the stage direction. Most productions put her in. And above all, Caesar is there. He is the focal point. He is isolated. He is the great man who comes in by himself, whom everybody else awaits. Not even Calpurnia is standing at his side. He has to summon her in order to speak to her. Everything happens in this scene according to what Caesar says. And he begins the scene by saying, "Calpurnia." And someone else says, "Peace ho!" Caesar speaks, "Calpurnia. Here, my lord," and she steps forward. Well, what does the great man have on his mind, as Maynard Mack asked? Well, he wants to remind his wife, on this extremely public occasion, in this very public place, that she hasn't given him any children yet, and that there is an old tradition about the races of young men at the Feast of the Lupercal, that if a woman is touched by a young racer during that feast, her curse of sterility may be removed. Caesar does not commit himself to belief in this ancient superstition. It is our elders who say it. Still, Calpurnia had better jolly well get out there and get tagged. It's a very revealing little incident, and its effectiveness derives from Shakespeare's imagination working within the context provided by Plutarch. Plutarch gave him the Lupercal festival with its race of young men and with its belief that a woman touched during the race by one of the racers might become fertile. But it was Shakespeare who creates the procession. Plutarch merely wrote that Caesar sat in the center of the ceremonies. It was Shakespeare who introduced Calpurnia into the incident and who mentions Calpurnia's failure to give birth. Shakespeare thus gives us a splendid brief incident demonstrating Caesar's simultaneous power and powerlessness. He is the all-powerful man. He has the public position. He is great Caesar. Peace ho when Caesar speaks. But in his private position, he has no children. He would like to be emperor. Later in this scene, off stage, he will be offered a crown. And Casca will come back and tell Brutus and Cassius all about it and say, I thought he put it aside somewhat reluctantly. And Antony handed it him again, and he put it aside even more slowly the second time, and even more slowly the third. He would like to be emperor. Therefore, he is naturally concerned. He has no heir of his body. And he is determined, at whatever cost to his wife in terms of public embarrassment, to get that heir, or failing that getting the heir itself, to establish publicly that it's her fault, not his, that he has no heirs. The man can rule everything, but he cannot command biology. And therefore, he's making a public relations gesture out of that failure in order to secure his position. It's a public event. It's a private event. Both are important. That's how the Roman plays work. I said last time that people of Shakespeare's time knew more about ancient Rome than they did about any other early or foreign civilization. But this heritage did not mean that they held a fixed, single, or monolithic view of Rome. Ignorant or uneducated people might have only one or two ideas about Rome. But educated Europeans of Shakespeare's time knew far too much about ancient Rome to be so fixed in their ideas. And this is true for centuries before Shakespeare's time as well. The Middle Ages and the Renaissance eagerly discussed major events in ancient Rome, but they derived different lessons from those events. The assassination of Julius Caesar was still a celebrated case. Some thought it was a hideous act. The greatest poet of the Middle Ages, Dante, put Cassius and Brutus in the very lowest part of hell. Along with Judas Iscariot, they were in the mouth of the devil himself. Treason against the Lord, against the master, against the ruler, was the worst of crimes. Michelangelo, however, who supported the Republican government of Florence, sculpted an heroic bust of Brutus that shows him as the embodiment of the highest nobility. Most people, of course, didn't write epic poems or create great sculpture. They were content simply to debate. Indeed, one of the most distinguished scholars of the Renaissance, Philip Melanchthon, suggested in a treatise on education that Caesar's murder was an excellent topic for debate in the universities. Now, in a humanist education, debate was not a fringe occupation as it is in a modern university. Debate was central to the curriculum. You showed off your intellectual skills not by writing a long paper or a dissertation or filling blue books with essays. You proved your intellectual resourcefulness and your verbal eloquence by public argument. A good topic was a topic on which arguments could be marshaled on both sides. The point of Melanchthon's recommendation that Caesar's murder be a examination topic was that it raised so many good issues. You could find arguments, and if you were a really good student, you could find counter-arguments, and if you were an excellent student, you could find counter-counter-arguments, and so on. The events were well known, and they were controversial. So much so, indeed, that Shakespeare endows his characters with an awareness of their own historical importance. They are deeply conscious of their past, of the great figures of the distant past, Aeneas, our great ancestor, of Lucius Junius Brutus, Brutus's own personal ancestor who drove the Tarquin kings from Rome and helped to found the Republic. They also mention distinguished figures of the immediate past. Pompey the Great, whom Caesar has overcome to achieve his present dominance in Rome. Cato, Portia's father, who was an heroic senator trying to defend the Republican Constitution, and who committed suicide rather than be taken captive by Caesar. Characters in the play endeavor to imitate this past, to be worthy of it, in order to earn the approval of the future, in order to earn the approval of posterity. That is, they think of themselves as characters in history, as having ancestors and having descendants and being part of a great heroic chain. As they try to impose order on events, they are also trying to write history, to inscribe what history will say of them. Now that is a very adult pursuit indeed. Middle-aged people will understand that better than high school students reading the play for the first time. When we become middle-aged, we become more aware of ourselves as persons who have done a certain amount in the world and wondering, will we get to do more, or is that it? How will people think of me in another generation? Will I be remembered at all? The most striking single instance of this imagined memory occurs as the conspirators stand over the dead body of Caesar. Brutus and Cassius propose that they enact a ceremony, that they all bathe their hands and their weapons in Caesar's blood, and then march forth to the marketplace, crying, "Peace, liberty, freedom." Cassius says, "How many ages hence shall this our lofty scene be acted over in states unborn and accents yet unknown?" Now, what Cassius is saying there can mean at least two things. First, they will all be models for future political liberators. Later generations engaged in similar struggles against tyranny will take them as precedents. A prophecy that, of course, proved true. In both the French and the American revolutions, the Roman struggle against dictatorship was consciously evoked by people who knew Roman history, who were brought up to know it. But Cassius' language suggests not only reenactment in real life history, but also reenactment on the stage. He calls it "this our lofty scene." It's almost as if Cassius were aware that William Shakespeare in 1600 years is going to write a play called Julius Caesar, and that in 1930 years Orson Welles will revive this play and put it on in modern dress as a parable against the tyranny of Mussolini and Hitler. Now that's just a single instance, however striking. A far more pervasive example of the imagination these characters have of the way they will be remembered lies in the way they think of themselves and speak of themselves. They are quite self-conscious. They frequently remark on their public images. They frequently note what is or is not appropriate for people of their position, people of their distinction. Caesar, for example, warning Antony to be careful with lean and hungry people like Cassius, observes, "I rather tell thee what is to be feared than what I fear, for always I am Caesar." And Brutus, rebuking Cassius over a matter of money, vows, "When Marcus Brutus grows so covetous, be ready, guards, with all your thunderbolts, dash him to pieces." They are highly conscious of the figures they cut. Indeed, in both those examples, Caesar and Brutus refer to themselves in the third person. They don't say, "I am I," they say, "I am Caesar." When Marcus Brutus grows so covetous. And it isn't an isolated example. It's a habit. Caesar calls himself Caesar some 18 times in the course of the play. Brutus calls himself Brutus or Marcus Brutus a dozen times. Cassius does it a few times too. So does Casca. So does Antony. So does Octavius. So even Portia. Now this can bother modern readers and audiences. Our opinion of the characters can hinge on this extraordinary degree of self-consciousness. You might say that they sound disgustingly proud, far too aware of their own virtues and achievements. 20 years ago, I saw a production in London, quite a good production, at the National Theatre, and I found myself being irritated by the habit, this third-person self-reference. And when we left the theater, I said to my companion, the trouble with this play is that everybody keeps saying that Brutus is the noblest man in Rome, and darn it, Brutus keeps agreeing with them. My companion happened to be an Englishwoman. An Englishwoman a generation older than I am, and a person of some position. And she looked at me kindly and rather condescendingly and said, yes, my dear Peter, you're the son of American democracy, and to people like you, self-importance is the worst sin in the calendar. Well, we argued about it all the way back to the restaurant, and I think perhaps now I was about 10% right. Caesar and Brutus do refer to themselves in the third person frequently. And on occasion, it does sound fatuous. Brutus saying, be ready, gods, with all your thunderbolts, dash him to pieces. Well, come on, surely one god with one thunderbolt is enough to take care of any man. You don't need to invoke all of Olympus. But what my friend pointed out to me was that other ages and other cultures have permitted and sometimes expected people to behave in a grander manner than we allow ourselves in American democracy now. Brutus and Caesar have indeed done distinguished things. It would be mock modesty in them to behave as if they were just ordinary folks chatting on the back porch. I cannot now find fault with Portia for referring to herself as a woman that Lord Brutus took to wife, a woman well reputed, Cato's daughter. She should be aware of the duties and the style demanded of a woman of her lineage and position. The British, who still have noble titles and the remnants of a class system, understand this better than we do. Even Republican societies in our own time have permitted the grand manner in special cases. The outstanding example, I think, in the second half of the 20th century is General de Gaulle, who deliberately adopted Caesarian loftiness, speaking of le grandeur de la France and his own personal grandeur, and used that as a political tool to build French morale and impress the importance of France upon other nations, even though France was a republic and he was only a president, not a king. Brutus and the conspirators assassinate a personage whom they themselves acknowledge to be the foremost man of all the world. They'd better acknowledge that what they're doing is important. They want to change the course of history. Brutus, indeed, proposes that they lift assassination to the level of ceremony, to the level of ritual. As he says, to carve Caesar as a sacrifice for the gods, not hew him as a carcass fit for hounds. Perhaps I better explain that line. When you carve a sacrifice, you open up the whole beast and you give it to the gods. You may read the entrails, indeed. It's very important how the entrails are arranged. There is such a sacrifice that takes place off stage in Act Two of this play. But when you hew a carcass for the hounds, you cut it up, you take off the good meat, and you throw the entrails to the dogs. That's their reward for participating in the hunt. It's quite a different process. The body is treated with much less respect. He wants to carve Caesar as a sacrifice for the gods. And he may be wise to insist on this. We in our time have seen many assassinations, many massacres, and we can sympathize with his effort to ceremonialize his deed. We know how a single political murder can lead to uncontrollable riot and bloodbath. To avoid such a disastrous development, Brutus wishes to proceed coolly, even artistically. Hence that ceremony that I mentioned earlier, bathing their hands in the weapons, in the blood, and going forth proclaiming peace, freedom, liberty. They behave with a dignified exhilaration suitable to religious ritual. And it's one of the many ceremonial moments that occur in Julius Caesar. There's also the celebration of Caesar's triumph at the start of the play, the celebration of the Lupercal with the procession that I talked about in the last lecture, the formal races, Mark Antony offering Caesar a crown, the formal funeral orations in the middle of the play from Brutus and from Antony over Caesar's body. But here I must qualify. All these ceremonies also contain or produce a contrary movement, a de-ceremonializing gesture, an ironic description. At the beginning of the play, the populace is celebrating Caesar's triumph, but they get rebuked by the tribunes. In the second scene, off stage, Caesar is offered a crown. On stage, Casca gives an envious and sarcastic and comic description of that event. And the deceremonializing is particularly striking in the matter of the blood and the weapons. The aim of Brutus and Cassius is religious ritual, an exalted purgation of tyranny in the blood of a sacrifice accompanied by a cry of peace and freedom. Brutus and Cassius would agree with Thomas Jefferson that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of tyrants. In fact, I think that Jefferson was thinking of Brutus and Cassius when he wrote that line. That may be a good thing to do, to propose. But something very curious happens to it when you actually do it on stage. What you see on stage is human gore, stage blood, something made to look as much like human gore as possible, being smeared around. And since there are seven conspirators surrounding the body of Caesar, and each of them has to approach and put his knife and his hands in a wound in order to get the blood, there's got to be a lot of blood. It's a difficult scene to stage, technically. The prop person really has to work on creating all that blood. It's going to drip. And the gore utterly contradicts the slogan of peace and freedom, at least from Caesar's point of view. A lot of blood around, that's peace and freedom, eh? And then Antony comes in, and he continues the de-ceremonializing. He enters under a promised safe conduct. He offers to shake hands with each of the conspirators. Now, handshaking has been a frequent gesture already in the play. All the scenes of conspiracy are marked conspicuously by handshaking as the conspirators make their agreements. But in this case, Antony shaking their hands is not a gesture of solidarity between men. It's a bluff on Antony's part. He's trying to gain time, and he wants to separate the conspirators one from another. It has the effect of taking those seven conspirators who'd got together in a ritual and are about to march into the marketplace as a body, crying peace and freedom and liberty, and splitting them apart into seven particular men. Each of them is named. Antony goes around saying, "Now, Marcus Brutus, do I shake thy hand? Now, Caius Cassius, yours," and so forth. He names every one of them. Above all, it's an extremely unpleasant thing to watch. It's so sloppy. at best untidy, at worst disgusting, to see a man shaking hands like a political hostess over a dead body when all of their hands are smeared with blood. If you, sitting in the audience, have any sense of physical empathy with the actors on stage, you say, how can they bear that? Why don't they go wash their hands? It's disgusting to have that half-dried blood gooey everything up. You wonder how Antony can bear it. In other words, what Shakespeare is doing is have Antony de-symbolize that blood. It isn't any longer nourishment for some symbolic tree of liberty. It's blood. It's the literal stuff. It used to run around inside Caesar's body, and now it's leaking all over the Capitol floor, and it's mucking everybody and everything up. And in the soliloquy with which Antony closes this long scene, Antony returns to that literal smelly blood, the carcass fit for hounds that Brutus and Cassius had been trying to rise above when they instituted the ritual. He returns to it by kneeling down over the body itself and directly addressing it in a way that he could not when the conspirators were on stage, and telling us in the audience what will happen. A curse shall light upon the limbs of men. Domestic fury and fierce civil strife shall cumber all the parts of Italy. Blood and destruction shall be so in use and dreadful objects so familiar that mothers shall but smile when they behold their infants quartered with the hands of war. All pity choked with custom of fell deeds, and Caesar's spirit ranging for revenge, with Ate by his side come hot from hell, shall in these confines with a monarch's voice cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. That this foul deed shall smell above the earth, with carrion men groaning for burial. It is real. It is a corpse. The blood smells. It isn't symbolic at all. Cassius and Brutus write history as noble sacrifice. Antony immediately rewrites it as bestial violence. Returns it to the dogs of war. Both versions, of course, contain truth. Both versions also sound entirely public. So far, I've discussed only those events that occur in the Senate House and in the Forum, and their political significance. But Shakespeare also writes private scenes, extremely important scenes, for Caesar and Brutus with their wives. One of the reasons why he's so important to us is in his own comprehensiveness. Shakespeare's perception of how the parts of our lives are vitally interconnected can make us realize that our private lives and our public lives are interwoven. I will conclude by trying to apply that generalization to the leading characters. First, Caesar. Caesar has faults. Shakespeare marks them sharply. He's at times vain, posturing. He's deaf in one ear. He has the falling sickness. He ignores clear warnings. He stops a whole procession to make a point about his wife's barrenness. But he's also direct. He's also decisive. He's very shrewd about other men. When you only read the play, you tend not to be very impressed with Caesar. Because it's a short part, there are not many lines, and the faults are very strongly marked. But on stage, it plays superbly. I don't think I'd have ever got a full grasp on it had I not seen that production in London I mentioned a little while ago. The part of Caesar was played by Sir John Gielgud. Well, with Gielgud's lofty bearing and his rich voice, he moved in a kind of rapt exaltation, in profound excitement. I found myself believing Caesar. After all, the man had conquered the world. Whatever his defects, he'd done something that no one else had done before. he'd earned the right to call himself Caesar in the third person, and to know, as it were, that that name would become a title, would become the title for all future emperors, become the title for kaisers and tsars as well. He had achieved an ideal imagination of himself. His faith in himself coincided with his deeds. It is ironic, of course, that he struck down immediately after he proclaims himself to be as constant as the northern star. Even Caesars are mortal. But he can fall as grandly as he lives. Et tu, Brute, then fall, Caesar. He dies not so much lamenting for himself, but lamenting the destruction of a great thing, that thoroughly realized conception of himself. We may find Caesars to be wholly objectionable. That depends upon your politics. But Shakespeare makes this Caesar a thing solidly achieved. Cassius has the same sort of energy, the same sort of delight in intense experience. In the storm, he bares his chest to the lightning flash. He once challenged Caesar to a swimming match in the Tiber on a raw and gusty day. It is his energy that drives the first half of the play, because Brutus is too reflective, and Shakespeare must save Antony until later on. Now, Cassius's energy is not as exalted as Caesar's. He lacks Caesar's sublime conception of himself. Cassius is a radical Republican, what I think we would now call a libertarian. He says, "I had as lief not be as live to be in awe of such a thing as I myself. I'd rather not live than stand in awe of another man. I'll not bow down to another human being." There's the heart of the character, that vibrant competitiveness, which is both personal and political. Indeed, with him, it's very hard to separate the personal from the political. His fierce independence goes so deep. In his remarks about Caesar himself, it's hard to separate the personal envy from the political disapproval. Now, such a man can be difficult. Cassius is testy and demanding, and occasionally he uses hasty and questionable means to achieve his goals. But he is also warm and passionate. He's an excellent friend, if you can cope with his testy moments. He's absolutely devoted to his cause and his allies. And in some ways, he's much more likable than Brutus. Whenever they disagree, and they have several disagreements, I always find myself sympathizing more with Cassius, because Brutus is so lofty and superior, and Cassius is more emotional. You will find Cassius at the heart of any revolution, any resistance movement. He is the passionate and determined energy that fuels opposition to tyranny. You will find him in the French Resistance. You could find him on the streets of Moscow when the Soviet Union fell apart. He's the man who is absolutely necessary to violently changing a political regime. Finally, Brutus. Brutus is a difficult tragic hero. It's relatively easy to write tragedies about emotional people like Othello and Macbeth, people who make mistakes when they're swept away by feeling. But Brutus commits a murder without personal motivation. He assassinates his friend for purely political reasons. Shakespeare finds in Brutus an heroic aspiration, an ideal aspiration rather like Julius Caesar's. A refusal to accept human limitation, a striving for perfection that probably cannot exist in reality. Brutus's ideal, his imagination of himself, is to act with total rationality, to conduct life on philosophical principles, on abstract notions of the good. Personally, he's a Stoic. He rejects emotion for reason. And as a Stoic, he's quite impressive. In the great quarrel scene in the tent with Cassius, I'm exasperated by the way he treats Cassius, as I said a moment ago, until Brutus reveals that Portia is dead. Brutus has been trying to repress a private grief, and that is perfectly characteristic of him, personal emotions ought not to interfere with military and political decisions. But the distress is there nonetheless, and it produces, as a side effect, this irritating condescension toward Cassius. On the political side, Brutus wishes to act altogether on principle, not on personalities. And here he's less impressive. To commit a political assassination purely on principle entails some very fine-spun reasoning. He worries about how Caesar might change if Caesar were crowned king or emperor. Now, the principle is sound. Power does corrupt. But Brutus cannot possibly know that a crowned Caesar would become totally corrupted. His argument to himself is a serpent's egg will become a serpent. But that simile begs the question. How do you know that Caesar is a serpent's egg to begin with, that he's got a serpent inside him? Neither Brutus nor any other person adduces any evidence from Caesar's previous career that he would abuse monarchical power in some hideous way. And there are suggestions in the play that some kind of monarchical power is necessary. The crowd is very fickle. They're enthusiastic first about Pompey, then about Caesar, then about Brutus, then about Antony. It does suggest that the republican government of Rome is breaking down. Brutus's reasoning is not well supported, but his mistake is at least plausible and thoroughly in accord with his own high-mindedness and his sense of civic responsibility. This is the story of a political politician who gets into trouble because he makes a mistake that is thoroughly philosophical and thoroughly political. The tragedy of Marcus Brutus is the tragedy of many a reformer, many an idealist, who truly believes that the rest of the world will behave like himself, that other people will try to behave as rationally and as responsibly as he himself is trying to behave. He cannot anticipate that Antony will inflame the mob and that the mob will become destructive.
The lecturer is Professor Peter Saccio. Professor Saccio is an award-winning professor and accomplished writer, actor, and theatrical director. He received his Ph.D. from Princeton University and began his teaching career at Dartmouth College in 1966, where he continues today. He has also served as a visiting professor at Wesleyan University and at University College in London. Professor Saccio has published or delivered at conferences more than 20 papers on Shakespeare and other dramatists. He is the author of two books, including Shakespeare's English Kings, which was released in 1977 and has become a classic in its field. He is also the editor of Thomas Middleton's comedy, A Mad World, My Masters, for the Oxford Complete Works of Thomas Middleton. In addition to his writing and public speaking career, Professor Saccio is also an accomplished director and actor. He has directed productions of Twelfth Night, Macbeth, and Cymbeline, and has devised and directed several programs of scenes from Shakespeare and from modern British drama. His acting credits include the Shakespearean roles of Casca, Angelo, Bassanio, and Henry IV, as well as various parts in the ancient and modern plays. His teaching awards include Dartmouth's J. Kenneth Huntington Memorial Award for Outstanding Teaching. Each of Professor Saccio's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Photographs of on-stage productions for this series were provided in part by the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C.
Hamlet is always old and always new. Any classic is. It is the mark of a classic that it is old, that many people have read it or seen it and enjoyed it and been enlightened by it. It has stood the test of time. It is also new. People are always rereading it, rediscovering it, reenacting it, finding that it offers new things to them. Finding things in it that they had forgotten were there. A favorite line for me in the play just now is, "Thoughts beyond the reaches of our souls." It's one of Hamlet's lines when he's first confronting the ghost. And I ran across it, quoted in an essay on Hamlet, and thought, you know, I've never really thought about that line before. And what a marvelous and paradoxical line it is. Thoughts beyond the reaches of our souls. Thoughts that we can't actually think. And I had to go back to the text and check that it really was there in Act 1, Scene 4. Shakespeare's Hamlet was always old and always new, even in 1600. In the opening scene of the play, we are introduced to Horatio, an alert, skeptical college classmate of Hamlet's who has been drawn out at midnight because he has refused to believe that something supernatural is happening on the battlements of Elsinore. His skepticism is marked in his first full line. What? Hath this thing appeared again tonight? Oddly enough, that question may have verbalized some reservations felt by the original audience of Hamlet at the Globe Theater in the year 1600. They might reasonably have asked, what? Has this thing appeared again this afternoon? The story of Hamlet was at least four centuries old by the time that Shakespeare got a hold of it. It had been first written fully down by a monk called Saxo Grammaticus in A History of the Danes. Saxo Grammaticus, the Saxon who could write. Very rare in the year 1200, apparently. It was taken up in French in the 16th century, by a man named Belforest, 1570. And then in the 1580s, there was a stage version in the Elizabethan theater, a play that we refer to now as the Hamlet, probably written by Thomas Kidd. But it's a play that is now lost. It may never have been put into print, but it certainly was played in the late 1580s and through the 1590s. It was also sneered at. All the surviving references to the Hamlet are derogatory. The passage from Thomas Nash, from which we deduce that Kidd wrote it, implies that it was a slapdash piece of formula work. Nash writes, "If you entreat him fair on a frosty morning, he will provide you whole Hamlets, I mean whole handfuls, of tragical speeches." Another Elizabethan mentions the voice of the ghost in this early Hamlet play. "The ghost which cried so miserably in the theater, like an oyster wife, Hamlet, revenge." Like an oyster wife? Cockles, mussels, Hamlet, revenge! Hardly the sort of thing that would harrow us with fear and wonder. The earlier ghosts of the Elizabethan stage provided Shakespeare's audience with very little preparation for what Shakespeare gives them in his ghost, what he calls the majesty of buried Denmark. And a ghost that is ominously silent for its first three appearances on stage, and sufficiently impressive without speaking and without shrieking to reduce a skeptical stoic like Horatio to fear and wonder. This thing is there, but it is also new. It has a new power, a new intensity. One of the new things about the play is its scale. It is Shakespeare's longest play, nearly 4,000 lines long, almost twice the length of Macbeth. An uncut performance takes somewhere between 4 and 5 hours. I've seen that twice. The Prince himself is by far Shakespeare's longest leading part. He's on stage for a tremendous stretch of time, particularly in the middle of the play. There is so much in it that even Shakespearean scholars may forget where a particular speech comes or the exact sequence of episodes. I've been reading student papers on Hamlet for many years, but students still point out things to me that I hadn't thought of, that I hadn't realized. The play is large not only in its scale, but in its range. There is a large range of characters. There is a king, of course, in a royal family, and the Prime Minister, Polonius, and his family. And there are other lords and courtiers. And there are university students, and there are traveling players, and there are grave diggers, and soldiers, and ambassadors, a priest, a ghost. And the range of action is very wide. A formal court council scene, rehearsing and putting on a play, soliloquizing, telling mother to shape up her sex life, digging a grave, burying a suicidal madwoman, and jumping in and out of the grave of that suicidal madwoman, fighting a duel at length with many passes, and killing some of the bystanders who happen to include the King and Queen of Denmark. And the facets of the hero's character are abundant as well. Hamlet is a prince, of course. He is also a son and a nephew, which makes him a stepson to the same man. He's a lover. He's a poet. He's a swordsman, a near suicide, a philosophy student, and a theater critic. That's why Hamlet is such a great test role. Any ambitious actor, any actor with classical ambitions, has got to play this part, to test himself against it. Can he encompass all that variety and abundance in a coherent performance? You're a serious actor, you've got to have Hamlet on your resume somewhere. In 1600, when it first came out, and now, the play is newly powerful and intense, not only because of the scale and the range of the action, but also because of its rhythm, its sequence, its presentation as a theatrical piece. If we want to see this thing again tonight, and again in many productions over a lifetime, it is because the thing is alive. Its rhythms and its constructions give us the obliquity, the solidity, and the occasional odd clarities that we recognize as the real thing. Life felt along the pulse. They give us visually and aurally the impression of genuine selves going through disturbing experience. The distinctive mark, I think, of this genuineness, this intensity and aliveness, is that it overtakes us. It ambushes us. It provides the shock of recognition. The habitual expectations of reasonable people are redirected, are countered, are ambushed by fresh events, fresh facts. And both the old pattern and the new development are rendered solidly enough so that the reasonable people must struggle to accommodate both in the same act of apprehension. And we in the audience must struggle likewise. It is by such overtaking in rhythm that the ghost of Hamlet first introduced into the play. The play opens with a tense series of challenges in the cold darkness of the battlements of Elsinore. And then that tenseness is salted by the skepticism of Horatio. And then that gives way, apparently going to be a piece of ordinary exposition. Nothing is really happening at the moment on the battlements, so Horatio suggests that they all sit down. And specifically, he invites Bernardo to give a full account of the previous night's events. Now, to the audience that doesn't know the story, or even to one who does, but has forgotten the exact sequence of incidents, it would appear that we're about to hear a narrative about the ghost. And Bernardo begins with appropriate fashion. Last night of all, when yon same star that's westward from the pole had made his course to illumine that part of heaven where now it burns, Marcellus and myself, the bell then beating one. I've just read five lines. The narrative is very leisurely. The syntax is suspended with numerous subordinate clauses. We're apparently in for a long story. But while this five-line sentence of iambic pentameter is gracefully unreeling itself, without yet having attained to the energy and dignity of a main verb, enter ghost. The ghost becomes the verb. The ghost usurps Bernardo's elegant syntax, displacing the narrative with fresh event. A visual effect overtakes the narrative line. Now, that's a small example. When Hamlet himself first sees the ghost, three scenes later, the pattern of overtaking is developed with much greater impact and significance. Hamlet's first sighting of the ghost is a moment very famous in theatrical history. Actors from the 17th century to the 20th have been minutely discussed, praised, or damned for the way they handled the first sighting of the ghost, Hamlet's start of astonishment. Frequently, they have been painted or photographed or etched or woodcut in that posture. The most famous example is in the 18th century, David Garrick, the greatest Shakespearean actor of the English 18th century. Garrick's Hamlet had been strolling upstage with his back to the audience, when Horatio suddenly calls to him, "Look, my lord, it comes." Garrick was wearing a full-length black cloak. Of course, he's entirely dressed in black. A large black hat, sword, and so forth. And he's going upstage. Horatio cries out, and he whirled around, this hand knocking off the hat. The cloak, of course, swung wide with the energy. The other hand extended at a lower level than the right hand. And his whole body leaning forward with a start of an astonishment at such an angle that the other actors on stage had to support him. He could not stand up by himself. It was an extravagant moment, as eagerly awaited at the Drury Lane Theater as a prima donna's high C is nowadays in an opera house. And it could be as savagely criticized as a high C in an opera house when the soprano cracks on the note. Boswell asked Dr. Johnson, "Would not you, sir, start as Mr. Garrick does if you saw a ghost?" And Johnson replied, "I hope not, sir. If I did, it would frighten the ghost."